Welcome to the Roots podcast. We're recording this live from World Roots 2017 in the beautiful city of Barcelona. And this is actually our biggest ever World Roots.
That's right. We've got 9,500 meetings, 40% higher than last year. We've got a record number of airlines in attendance. And it's been a fantastic event so far.
Yeah, and I think you could see that yesterday when we had Willie Walsh, CEO of IAG. He was on stage in a packed keynote theatre yesterday. He was standing room only and a fantastic discussion. He covered a lot of ground, including the launch of Level.
Yeah, very timely discussion as well, Level. Long-haul, low-cost, which, as we say on the outset, might be the future of the industry. Willie Walsh was very confident that he could make the model work profitably as well.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that it was only in March this year that Level was announced and then up in the air 3 months later. So unbelievable story, really, and he talked a lot about that.
Planning for 30 aircraft by 2022.
So without any further ado, here's the podcast, recorded live from World Roots 2017. This is the full keynote address by Willie Walsh, interviewed by John Strickland. This episode is sponsored by OAG, so thank you for their support and enjoy the podcast.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you can join us. Hope you had a nice lunch and all ready to go for this session. Willie, as you heard, has had a substantial career in diversity and success. I hate to say, but Willie, it's getting close to 40 years, isn't it?
Yep.
I mean, you're a man and boy. I mean, you're piloting at the age of 17, and I think you were flying before you were driving a car, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true, yeah.
You know, Willie is known for having turned around Aer Lingus, then came over to British Airways, and again, the airline was going through tough times, and he turned that company around. Then came in to head up IAG, which was a new creation, and is today the leading, I hate this word, but legacy group. It's kind of legacy, but it's not really, because you actually have a mix of airlines. So running IAG, which has airlines including British Airways, Iberia, Vueling, and Aer Lingus, and of course the new airline we're going to talk about shortly, Level. So Willie, welcome to Barcelona, and I think you've been to Roots before, haven't you?
I have, yeah. It's been a few years, but I have been to Roots before.
But now this town is a particularly important town for you as a group. I think all your airlines fly to Barcelona, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Barcelona is very important because clearly it's the main base for Vueling, which is a significant part of the group, but we have all of our airlines flying here, and as you know, in June of last, or sorry, this year, time flies, but in June of this year, we launched Level, started flying on the 1st of June. We announced the launch on the 17th of March and started flying on the 1st of June, not the way you would normally do things, but we saw an opportunity, and we were keen to get airborne as quickly as possible. So I think it demonstrates the strength of IAG and also the flexibility of IAG, because that's not the sort of thing, a legacy group would do, you know, to announce you're starting a new airline brand and start flying within 2 months of actually getting going.
Well, I see my aircraft were out working yesterday, because when I came in about 10:50 yesterday morning, I didn't see either of the 330s.
So yeah, no, it's going extremely well. Yeah. I have to say we've been positively surprised at every level. Passenger customer demand is much stronger than we thought it would be. I was looking at the presentation there earlier. You know, we're getting about just over 17 hours at the moment utilization out of the aircraft per day. Our punctuality in August was up near over 90%, which is pretty good for a new start of flying long haul. And it's been really fascinating to watch the way the demand for the service has grown over the short time we've been operating.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to more detail on Level shortly, but we've got this title, Willie, to talk about this afternoon, which is why long haul low cost will dominate the skies by 2020 and what you can do about that. Do you believe in that? Because I don't myself see that it's going to dominate the skies.
No, I don't think it'll dominate, but you know, we are convinced there is a business model there. I think what we've seen so far, as you know, we've watched Norwegian develop for some time, and I'm a great fan of Bjorn. We've been interested in how he's demonstrated that the customer proposition works. He hasn't quite, to my mind anyway, demonstrated that the business works. Because the financial performance is not where you would want it to be. So we're convinced there is a profitable segment that can be served, provided you have low cost. Yeah. And with Level, we clearly have low cost. You know, it's been structured with low cost in mind. So this is a new customer segment. The people flying with us are predominantly people who would not have flown long haul before.
No.
And one of the things we've realized, because in our original business case when we launched Level, we assumed there would be some cannibalization from our flying out of Madrid principally, maybe some out of London as well. We haven't seen that.
Right.
And you know, we've good data on the customers that are flying with us, and it's very clear to us this is a new customer base for IAG.
But the model itself, I mean, I think I saw you quoted in a time at Aer Lingus, you were reflecting back on your time at Aer Lingus, when you said something along the lines of, you know, we keep seeing these harps going past a window, we don't do something about it, but we know more shamrocks.
Yeah.
But short or low cost is, you know, tried and tested, proven, I think, pretty well worldwide now.
Yeah.
But this is not simply a copy-paste into the long-haul arena, is it? There's a big list of, you know, you can't do the same things on the checklist of short or low cost. I mean, we saw the slides about utilization, but it's hard to get substantially more utilization than, say, a legacy would have done to work your pilots harder and so on.
I would accept that. I think when we see more narrow-body long-haul aircraft, particularly the 321L or, you know, the 737 is interesting, but I don't think it has the range, from our point of view, it doesn't have the range and the flexibility that we would like to see. But with the 321L, or that's certainly an aircraft where we think you can get significantly greater utilization, where you combine, you know, the traditional transatlantic flying with some short haul. So for Aer Lingus, as you know, we've already announced 7 8 321LRs for Aer Lingus. We're actually looking at more, and the Aer Lingus management team are putting forward a case which we'll consider in a couple of weeks' time. You know, they believe that they could significantly expand their transatlantic operation with the 321L, or maybe up to 12 aircraft in the short to medium term. And when you combine the transatlantic operation with what would be considered downtime between transatlantic flying with a short-haul network. So, you know, today Aer Lingus will operate a 330 on the transatlantic. It'll come into Dublin, and before it operates westbound again, they will send the aircraft to somewhere like Faro or Malaga. So, in effect, you're getting free utilization out of the aircraft, and that's for a 330.
Absolutely.
Clearly, a 321LR will have much greater flexibility on the short-haul network.
Well, you're touching on a lot of things I want to come, all of them I want to come back to, but just again, looking more broadly, I mean, the model's been around in some shape or form for a few years now around the world. I think perhaps the biggest was, in getting started, was AirAsia X. Mm. Now, looking at their results, it's not been a sort of bed of roses by any means. I think they've just about started to make some money in the last year, but they've had challenges. But other models around it are quite different. But broadly, until some, as you said, perhaps modest profitability with Norwegian, we haven't really seen strong results. So the question is, how sustainable is it going to be, and how wide is it going to become as a model?
Well, no, we're convinced it worked. And in fact, we wouldn't do it if we weren't convinced that this is a model that can generate the returns that we've set for the rest of the group. So we're not making a separate case for Level. Level will need to demonstrate that it can, you know, achieve a return on invested capital of 15%, similar to the rest of the airlines in the group. And we wouldn't be investing in the airline unless it can demonstrate that. So what we've seen this year is, at an operating level, Level will be profitable this year.
Already.
Yeah. Now, the level of profit, I'm going to use Level all the time. So, but, you know, the level of profitability will not be where you, but, you know, for a startup to make an operating profit, at an operating level, when we, you know, take out some of the one-off costs associated with it, I think that's a great achievement.
Yeah. But again, doing a bit of compare and contrast, both internally in IAG and around the track. I mean, AirAsia X, as I mentioned, was struggling. It relies a lot on feed traffic. Then you have carriers like Jetstar, which are within a legacy group. You have Scoot, and Scoot, I was looking up when it was born, I think it's about 3 years ago, they announced that their break-even load factor was 120%.
Yeah.
I think it's gone down to a modest 87% or something now, but their CEO at the time was quoted as saying this model will take a long time to make money, but strategically we've got to do it. So coming back to your point that you had a business case, it's got to have to make a return.
Yeah.
You didn't simply look around the track and learning from, this is why I mentioned what you said in Aer Lingus, you saw what Ryanair was doing, you had to do something pretty quick, and it was a bit of a reaction. You've looked and seen, as you described, Norwegians, they're succeeding, at least from a customer point of view, maybe not so much profitability. You didn't do this just to, like, kill off competition.
No.
It's a genuine business objective, and of course protecting yourself as well.
No, this is a model. There is a customer segment there. So if we look at what we've seen with Level, as I said, the customers flying with us are not our traditional customers. And in the main, we think these are people who may have been flying short haul. but probably didn't consider long haul as an option for them,
right,
because there wasn't availability at the price that they were prepared to pay. And that's what this segment is all about. So the critical issue is the cost base. So as you know, we've chosen the 330-200 in a high-density configuration, 314 seats, 21 premium economy. And that compares to Norwegians, you know, like for like would be their 787-8 with 290, I think they have 293 seats, 291 maybe. 291. Slightly different configuration. And you know, we acknowledge that the 787 does have a cost advantage when it comes to fuel. So I went out on the first flight, Barcelona to Los Angeles, and I got our guys to run a 787 flight plan, like for like, so
right,
in a Norwegian configuration, because as you know, we have 787s in British Airways. Mm-hmm. So I got a 787 flight plan and the 330 flight plan, and on the day, like for like, the 330-200 burnt 6 tons more fuel. So, you know, today, what, $500 a metric ton, you're talking about $3,000 for the trip. Now, we have 23 more seats. You know, Norwegians' average seat factor is 93%, similar to ours. So, you know, if you fill more of those seats, you'll cover that. But the significant issue for us is the ownership cost. And, you know, we estimate that our ownership cost on a 330-200 is at least $400,000 per month cheaper than Norwegian. So, fuel would want to be a very high price to be able to offset the ownership cost advantage. So when we look at the totality of the costs, the 330-200 at today's fuel price with the network that we're operating is significantly lower in overall cost than the 787.
Well, because, you know, when Bjorn launched, he was I can't remember, he was the first, one of the first airlines into service with 787.
Yeah.
Maybe it was ANA who was the first. And he championed, you know, the 787's economics as being his like raison d'etre to make the model work. But as you said, it's a new expensive plane. And sometimes I look around, if you've got Michael O'Leary, he's expressed a personal ambition. It may not be Ryanair, but a Michael O'Leary-led airline, Ryanair or not, to do long or low cost. But he said, I can't get aircraft at the right price.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. You've gone for current generation aircraft, but they're new. The additional ones, I believe, are going to be new as well. The other three you've announced. But as you said, you know, it's divided by the seats. You get a very economic proposition compared to the ownership cost.
Yeah, and you've got to look at every aspect of it, even when it comes to crew costs. So the 330, there are plenty of Airbus qualified people. You know, there are very few 787 qualified people. So, you know, Norwegian has had to bear the additional expense of type rating people for the 787. It's a much easier type conversion if you've got somebody who's already qualified to fly, you know, an A320 to do a 330. So there's a bigger pool of pilots available. I think Norwegian would be fair to say he's paying a premium to the market to try and recruit people. And we've seen what's been happening, you know, the debate in recent days as to where they're recruiting their pilots from. So, you know, we looked at every aspect of the cost. And what we were able to demonstrate was that with the exception of fuel, where we acknowledge today with the aircraft, there is a price disadvantage. You know, every other heading, we have a cost advantage over Norwegian. And that's what gives us confidence that if you look at the commercial side of the business, which they've proven can work, provided you have the cost right, then you can make a profitable operation. And that's where we are today.
Okay.
So going forward, you know, we've announced three more aircraft for level next year. For 2019, we're looking at maybe 13 aircraft.
In total,
We'll be up to about 13. In fact, we could stretch that pretty quickly. And then, you know, 2022, we could have up to 30 aircraft.
Right.
So going back to your earlier question, you know, will it dominate? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to dominate the skies, but it is going to be a much more significant feature of the industry going forward.
Now, another interesting observation, I mean, even, you know, Norwegian was on the scene, and we, outside, we didn't know you were even thinking about level, but it looked to me, within IAG, you were already taking certain steps to do a test, if you like, of a model. I mean, you said often that Aer Lingus is a cost leader across the Atlantic, you know, lean and mean, and as you say, well-positioned in Dublin, growing its North Atlantic operation. So that was one thing that you're building on, as you said, with 321neos coming down the pipeline. But very, very interesting, last year, when BA announced they were going to densify the 777-200 is at least a subset of the fleet and at Gatwick, and came on head-to-head with Norwegian on some of the routes. So is that a conscious thing that even before level came to fruition, you thought, let's do several tests and see what is a merit in each.
Yeah, I think, you know, we all stood back for many years with the contrast between the full service and the low cost. And we tried to explain to people in a very difficult way why, you know, the costs were actually, or the prices were actually competitive. You know, one is unbundled, the other is, and to be honest, people didn't get it because they just saw the price. You know, what we decided was, you know, if you look at what Aer Lingus is doing, and I would argue Aer Lingus is probably a good example of a successful, profitable, low-cost transatlantic. They're not long-haul, they're transatlantic. No. And, you know, we don't use the term long-haul low-cost. We talk about, you know, new generation or right. next generation long-haul. But they're clearly very profitable. But you can see what they've done recently. They've launched a saver fare.
Changed the fare structure.
Yeah, so we've changed. So what we said is, rather than trying to convince people that, you know, the prices are the same, one is bundled, one is unbundled, we said, okay, unbundle and give people the choice. And that's what we're doing. And that's what this customer segment wants. You know, they want cheap fares and they want choice and they want to have the option of, you know, fulfilling their needs, not what you tell them you're going to get. And I think part of the problem is when this gets reported on in the media, I think the focus is always negative. So, you know, even ourselves, I think we use the term densification of our 777s. I would say all we're doing is properly configuring our
777s. Coming into line with what other people have
exactly.
already done.
You know, so many, most airlines have been operating 10 abreast in 777s. We were wasting space on the aircraft the way we had configured it. But that's interpreted as a negative. Mm-hmm. I think what we've got to do, and we make no apologies for this, you know, we are focused on how can we be more efficient? Mm-hmm. And in being more efficient, how will that enable us to be more attractive in terms of the pricing we can offer customers? And clearly, how can we be more profitable? Because this is an industry that has never generated sufficient profitability to demonstrate that it can make these long-term investments, and we're determined to do that. So, you know, the market has changed. I give credit to Norwegian for demonstrating that customers are prepared to buy a transatlantic flight that is unbundled, you know, that they're not demanding a meal. And you saw some of the quotes on our first flight, Barcelona to Los Angeles. You know, clearly we were monitoring the number of people who had booked a meal before they before the day of travel.
Yes.
And we were actually worried that maybe people didn't understand that this was different and that we were going to turn up on that flight
expecting a meal
and not get it. So, you know, we sent an email to everybody, you know, reminding them that if they want a meal, that's an extra.
Right.
And they can order it in advance or they can buy food on board the aircraft. And, you know, of the 314 people that were on that flight, I think we had 12 customers who were surprised. Everybody else fully aware of what it meant. So, you know, there is a customer segment. There's definitely a market segment here that can be served in a profitable way, and that's why we're
just tell us about, you know, the actual genesis of Level. You know, you're already well down the track of, you know, using the cost base of Aer Lingus. You decided and announced for densification with BA. How long did this take from saying, right, let's do something specific? And where did that come from? Is that in like the strategy area of IAG, like Robert Boyle's area?
Yeah, so our strategy group has been looking at this for, I'd say, at least 3 years. You know, we've been analysing the market. We've been trying to understand what's going on there. We've been testing whether there was a segment that could be profitable. Once we were convinced that that was the case, our intention actually was to launch in Barcelona in 2018. Fortunately for us, we had two aircraft, two A330s, available to us.
Right.
So rather than wait a year, we launched a year earlier than we planned. So that's why, as I said, we announced on the 17th of March that we were going to start flying on the 1st of June. The way we did it was we launched an airline brand. So Level today is a brand.
Mm-hmm.
You could say we've taken, you know, cost control to the extreme in that we don't have a CEO.
I was just going to ask you, I mean, it doesn't seem externally to have a management structure as such, is it run?
We've used the structure within the group. So we've been using people already working for us together. Now, that's not sustainable going forward. You know, we were able to do that to launch and get airborne a year ahead of our plans. We're using the Iberia AOC. We're using pilots and cabin crew from Iberia who have volunteered to transfer and do this on terms that
I was going to say, the terms are better. I mean, they're more cost-effective, but not simply Iberia standard.
No, the terms are appropriate to the market, and they recognise that to be competitive in this segment. You know, if we're to invest to grow we have to be profitable, and therefore there has to be a different way of operating. So it's a, you know, it's a completely fresh approach to the business. We've been using, I don't think it's any secret, we've been using BCG to do some brand work for us, you know, analysing the market, understanding the different customer segments, and then understanding where our brands are strong within those segments. And it was quickly apparent to us, in fact, before we had completed the work, that to be successful in this segment, we needed a new brand. You know, we debated whether we could stretch our existing brands, whether it was possible for them to operate in this segment with the brand that we had. And we decided actually to do it properly and to fulfill the longer term ambition that creating a new brand was the right thing to do. And that's why we created Level. I'll be honest with you, I told people I didn't want to be involved in the debate. Nice. I didn't even want a choice of two names, because I knew if I was given two, I would hate both of them. So I said, just tell me what you're going to call it. And I said, I won't like it, but tell me what you're going to call it. And when I saw it first, I thought, Jesus Christ, you know. But actually, you know, when I saw the pitch, it quickly grew on me, and I warmed to it. And I think it's a great brand.
I think you wore a T-shirt, haven't you? When you
we dressed up. Yeah,
I thought you'd have come about today, Willie.
Yeah, we did. I'm not allowed.
Don't want to show bias.
The brand people won't let me wear it anymore. Yeah. Well, as somebody said, you know, the amount of publicity you get when three middle-aged men dress up with T-shirts, you know, it's not the sort of thing you want to do. Yeah. So, we decided. Luis and Javier are here. We decided when we did the launch on the 17th of March, which of course was St. Patrick's Day. It was
what a day.
So we had celebrated St. Patrick's Day the day before, but the three of us were fighting over, you know, which T-shirts we were going to wear. So you know, we don't like looking at those photos, but not pretty, but it generated a lot of publicity.
You took a lesson out of Michael's book.
Yeah, and you know, like I've seen Michael do that for years. Yeah. In fact, we copied him a lot when we did the restructuring of Aer Lingus back in 2001. You know, how do you generate free publicity? And that's what this is all about. You know, for Level, we're not using the traditional media channels to advertise.
More social media.
Much more focused on social media and digital,
And it's not, I guess, a mistake, not by accident, rather, you put it in Barcelona, because one of the challenges, it seems to me, coming back to what you can't do a copy-paste to short or low cost, is this thorny question of feed. I mean, air routes, generally speaking, unless they're nice and big volume markets, are not nice and neat all year round. You have seasonality, you know, even on short haul, you try to balance summer and winter usage of your planes. But I guess you looked at that and thought, we have to feed. We can't, in some markets, rely just on point-to-point at an acceptable price.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think with the wide-body aircraft, if you're doing long haul, you do need feed. Now, we launched it without feeding, without tying into the Vueling network. But clearly, you know, we have the advantage of Vueling based in Barcelona with an extensive network across Europe. So when you can have a ready-made network, and I think this is probably one of the challenges Norwegian has, is that, you know, to support the long-haul network, and Bjorn has been quite open about this, you know, to make the long-haul model, as he sees it work, he needs feed. So he's having to develop a short-haul network to feed his long-haul. We had it in place already. Yeah. So you can quickly tap into the point-to-point market, which was actually much stronger than we thought.
Right.
But also then you have the added advantage of being able to feed it. And feed becomes even more critical when you start increasing frequencies.
Yeah.
You know, when you start trying to... And going daily is clearly an ambition. It is more efficient if you have a daily
crew patterns and so on. Yeah.
I think the model will change slightly again when you start using narrow-body aircraft. You know, we've already seen that with Aer Lingus. You know, we think we can extend the network quite significantly with the narrow-body without having as much dependence on feed. You'd still need some feed, but there's a slight difference between using wide-body and using narrow-body aircraft.
You know, I come from the old legacy world, so I still wrestle with, you know, the challenge. If you get somebody else doing the feed, that's in-house. But if you're trying to get an agreement with somebody else, there's always this question of, if you're having a competitive price, who's going to get a share of the revenue? You know, because you've got to have a competitive ticket price, you know, against whatever else is an offer, and then usually the poor relations are short-haul airlines. So how do you see that, internal versus working with somebody else?
Well, I'll talk about the internal one, because if you look at Aer Lingus, what they do is, in effect, they do some of fares, some of sectors.
Right.
So you connect short-haul to long-haul, you pay the short-haul sector fare, you pay the long-haul sector fare, you just combine the two. So, you know, Stephen Cameron is very clear. His short-haul business needs to be able to stand on its own 2 feet. It can't depend on artificial financial transfer from a more profitable long-haul network. That if we're to invest and be competitive in a short-haul network, it has to be profitable in its own right. So it's sum of sectors.
Yeah.
You've seen what's been announced.
Gatwick.
Yeah. Now, Gatwick's an interesting development on this because it's sum of sectors plus a huge fee.
Yeah.
I think it's 35 quid.
Right.
So maybe we've missed something here. You know, if you can do some of sectors.
And a fee.
That's very different to where it was always sort of, you know, you discount the connecting traffic because it's.
Inconvenience.
It's inconvenience and it's always been more price sensitive. But, you know, we've seen now some of sectors plus a fee. Now, I don't think what Gatwick have announced, and don't forget, Gatwick announced this over two years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be hugely successful. And it demonstrates as well that it's only where you have a convenient connection. So, you know, EasyJet will not change its short-haul network or its schedules to feed the long-haul.
Yeah, I think some of them as much as 8 hours, eight-hour connection times.
Yeah, now, if somebody's going to pay 8 hours to transfer between EasyJet and Norwegian at Gatwick Airport... Yeah.
And the other thing, I think you can check your bag in, but you've got to check it in. You've got to get it off one flight, check it in. I think maybe airside, but it's not like your bag goes all the way through and you have that hassle off your mind.
So, you know, I think there are opportunities. Clearly we'll look at Dublin. So we have, Aer Lingus and Ryanair have been in discussions.
Is that getting anywhere? Because
it's
an IT issue.
IT is always an issue, but it is. And, you know, credit to the teams in both companies that they are looking for simple IT solutions, and I think they've probably identified one. So I'd be surprised if by next summer we're not doing Ryanair to Aer Lingus speed.
And would that be more likely than it would be through proposition take away that?
Yeah, we'll wait and see. There is no baggage hall connectivity at Dublin Airport, so we're going to have to get the bag from one terminal to the other. And probably the easiest way to do that is to work with the airport to facilitate the baggage transfer. And it may mean you pick up your bag from one flight and, you know, you drop it off at an airside connecting point in the baggage hall. So I think there is an opportunity. Certainly, you know, we've been very clear. We've no principled objection to working with Ryanair. If the customer is happy to self-connect, well, then why don't we try and make it a little bit easier? So as I said, I'd be optimistic and hopeful that we will be doing work with Ryanair at Dublin Airport.
I mean, one thing I just still wonder with Ryanair, I mean, Michael O'Leary's talked about this a lot, but what is really in it for him? When he's flying at 97% full, which, you know, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have believed an airline could regularly fly 97% full, but they do. There's hardly any space. Now, obviously, they're going to grow, but if there is an answer to, you know, if it is something in it for him, it would be a pretty formidable network between Aer Lingus and Dublin.
It's just sum of sectors.
Yeah,
so you know, there's no loss.
If a customer buys at that price.
Yeah. And of course, what you're saying is, although they'll say 97% seat factors, you know, that includes people who buy the ticket and don't try.
No show.
Yeah.
No.
So, it is possible, and we'll probably see it someday soon that people will be reporting seat factors in excess of 100%.
Yes.
I think so long as you have a simple pricing model that doesn't require discounting on one side or the other and is simple for the customer to understand that you pay the sector fare on the short haul, the sector fare on the long haul, and you just combine the two in a more convenient way.
Okay.
So that's the simple model that we're looking at.
And you haven't said where officially Level may go next beyond Barcelona, but you said you could look at places like Rome, Fiumicino, dwelling base, Paris.
Well,
we
have three aircraft on the way. I think with the success of Barcelona, we could maybe put, of the three aircraft, we might look
more
at expanding the presence of Barcelona, which is, as I said, been very attractive and has worked very well for us. And then, the two principal European cities that we've looked at are Paris and Rome. Again, given the dwelling presence at Rome and at Paris, we have a short-haul network. And in fact, as you know, all of our airlines fly to these airports, both Rome and Paris. So, you know, we could do that. So we'll make a decision on that within the next couple of months. I think we're pretty clear in terms of our preference. We do prefer one over the other. So I think it will be, at least two aircraft in the new base rather than splitting, you know, one aircraft in Paris and one aircraft in Rome. I think it would be at least two, potentially three, but we would look at expanding the Barcelona presence from today's two aircraft to three aircraft as well. So there's still a bit to play for. You know, we've talked openly about the potential to serve Barcelona to Tokyo. You know, we know there's demand for a service. It's going east is a little bit more complex than going west, but it's an opportunity that we will look at.
Because that was another question I was going to ask you. I mean, is it all eggs in the North Atlantic basket? Well, evidently no, because the North Atlantic seems to be getting more and more crowded in terms of supply at the moment. So if you look at, you know, what you're doing, what BA as a traditional strong carrier is doing, or people like WOW and so on.
Yeah, but it's a big market. Yeah. You know, if you look at it, Aer Lingus is probably one of the fastest growing transatlantic airlines out there. You know, it doesn't appear on the sort of low cost side of things, but I would argue it is the best example of you know, a profitable low cost. You know, focusing on the transatlantic, and it's focusing on the North Atlantic rather than the South Atlantic. So when we're looking at transatlantic, we're looking both north and south.
Right.
And clearly that's an area where IAG has significant strength, both North Atlantic and South Atlantic. So yeah, but there's a big market. It's growing. There are cities that are underserved. As you've seen with British Airways continues to expand the network, serving more US cities. And, you know, that's been possible because of the demand that exists, but also because of the relationship we have with American Airlines, which gives us a much better, you know, customer proposition on both sides of the Atlantic with their network and their presence in key U.S. cities. So, you know, I would expect BA to continue to expand. So you'll see BA flying to some more cities. Siberia will fly to more. Aer Lingus will expand into more, and clearly Level has the opportunity to expand as well.
And you said early on that you see that there's a lot of new customers who maybe hadn't flown before, yeah, haven't really thought about the possibility, so you don't really have any big worry about cannibalisation of existing legacy, mainline members of a group like BA in Iberia.
Well, the truth is, so we launched with four routes out of Barcelona, so we're flying to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, Punta Cana, and Buenos Aires. We've seen zero cannibalization. You know, we've been looking to see, can we identify any cannibalization, principally to the Iberia network over Madrid, and we've not been able to identify any. Now, our business case did assume that there would be some, but we haven't seen that. And as I said, because we have a lot of customer data, you know, these aren't the customers flying with Level so far, are not customers that would have been flying with us. Now, going forward, one of the key advantages we have at IAG, obviously, is we have a loyalty program, Avios. And because people will be able to redeem their points on Level, we would expect that to, you will start seeing customers who have earned points on other parts of the IAG family will be able to redeem their points at Level, and we will get some, if you like, transfer, but that's unlikely to be cannibalization. In fact, that's likely to be a net positive for us. So, you know, I think this is one of the key opportunities we have. Our view is that the people who are operating in this segment, they don't need a loyalty program. That's not something that they're looking for. But clearly, because of the network we'll have and the opportunity that we will have for people to redeem points, we think that's going to be particularly attractive.
Strong point.
As well.
Now, I mean, we've talked a lot about it being very price-driven, but you have got you've got a premium segment, and you mentioned having premium seats here. I think that's an interesting development, just as, you know, premium economy now seems to be getting ever stronger in traditional airlines. Do you see that as an important part of the business model? Because you don't want to be in a situation where you've just got a price to the lowest all the time for every seat.
Yeah, so we have 21 premium economy seats, 37-inch pitch. It's an all-in, it's a bundled product.
So you get the food and entertainment.
It's the whole lot. It's very good. I flew on it, 37-inch nights pitch. It's different. I think Norwegian has a 46-inch pitch.
Right.
So, you know, we're very clear. We're not going to have a premium flatbed product serving this segment. But, you know, the premium economy has been a very successful segment for us. British Airways has used that very well. We've got premium economy now on Iberia. You know, it is definitely an area where there is demand. You can argue that there's a bit of cannibalization, people buying
trading,
but there's also trading
up
as well. So overall, we see it as being a profitable part. So it's a small cabin for us, 21 seats. I don't see that growing, but it clearly identifies therefore segments of the market that we're likely to serve. So people have asked me about, you know, would Level operate in London? It could do, but you know, when we look at London, London has a very significant premium market, and we're not going to serve that market with Level. So it is very much the, you know, what we call frugal fun segment, customer segment.
Yeah, because I'd wondered if, you know, you might have, if you like, the Fortress Heathrow high yields, and you could put it into Gatwick alongside instead of BA, but you think that's less likely.
I don't understand this Fortress Heathrow concept. You'll have to explain that to me.
Yeah, we'll have a chat later.
Yeah, but no, you know, we clearly have our aircraft configured to fit the demand in the markets. There's a very strong premium demand at Heathrow. It's one of the reasons why, when you look at the British Airways configuration, it works very well in London. It doesn't work as well when you move outside of London, and it's one of the main reasons why BA doesn't operate long-haul services from other parts of the UK, because the premium demand is not as strong.
Right.
You know, we used to, as you well know, operate a 767 with 24 club seats out of Manchester, Manchester, New York. You know, I saw a stat, I think we were looking earlier, there was a statistic about sold seat factor on in first class being about 25%.
Right.
And most of the seats are occupied by staff or upgrades. You know, our sold seat factor in first class on British Airways is less than 50%. Now, we use it tactically to upgrade people, and we also, you know, we sell it as part of the club cabin as well in certain sectors where we know there is a strong first-class demand. So the markets are very different, and you know, one of the key things to get right is the configuration of your aircraft so that you're maximizing the utilization of the aircraft, the asset. And that's why, you know, the configuration we have with Level 21 premium economy, 293 economy seats, 31-inch seat pitch, we think is the right sort of configuration.
Now, what about your fellow you know, large groupings in Europe? We've seen Lufthansa is rolling out Eurowings on the long-haul side. They began in Cologne and now opening up several German airports. And we talked about unusual names. Air France has set up June, I think it's J-O-O-N, or where they say it's not a low-cost airline, it's lower cost than Air France. I know I've asked you before about Air France's long-term survival chances overall. Is this going to help them? Is Eurowings going to help Lufthansa?
Well, it's, look, you know, if you're going to be profitable, you have to have a low cost, and they're not low cost. And you know, we've seen how low your cost needs to be profitable, to generate the sort of returns that you need to generate to justify the investment that you're going to make. So, you know, there will be lots of airlines who will say they have a successful long-haul low cost. It won't be profitable. It will not cover their cost of capital because their cost base will not be low. So, you know, the only people who will succeed in this segment and make money will be airlines that have a genuine low cost. And we have. And that's the difference between the structure of IAG and the structure of some of our competitors, you know, that they don't have low cost. So in the case of Air France, you know, calling it a lower cost just means, you know, less losses, but it doesn't mean profitable. That's not a success. So you know, I think we will be able to demonstrate, as we have with Aer Lingus and as we have with the other airlines in the group, that we can be profitable in all of these segments, and we can sustain that profitability through the cycle. But you know, others, you know, won't. And we've seen, you know, airlines come and go.
Yeah.
You know, putting a label of low cost on an airline does not guarantee success.
Make it profitable.
You know, what guarantees success is if its cost base is genuinely low cost.
And we talked about aircraft before, but just come back to that briefly. You mentioned the next generation narrow body, the 321neo. Does that, and is it going to continue to have big advantages over the Boeing 747 MAX family? Has Boeing not quite got it right on that one?
Well, you know, I don't think Boeing designed that as a transatlantic aircraft. So for us, the 321LR operating out of Dublin for Aer Lingus, we think is perfect. In fact, the route economics on the 321LR are as good as the Aer Lingus 330s. And that's fantastic when you can get a narrow-body aircraft with the same sort of unit costs as the wide-body aircraft. So it enables us to, for example, operate two 321s instead of a single A330, which from a hub point of view, as you would know, gives you a lot more opportunities to expand the hub, providing services, you know, double daily service, where today it's a single daily service. So you know, we think it will change things. And the 321LR, NEO-LR, has the range that,
right.
that we believe you would need and the flexibility that we believe you need to make that
Do you think also when Boeing makes this decision on what they're calling the MOM, you know, the kind of 757 replacement, but probably a bit bigger, is that going to also play a role in this? How
it, it could do, but it's a bit late. You know, the, you know,
should have done it sooner.
Yeah, we'll be operating the 321 on the Transatlantic in 2019. You know, we're very keen to get access to early deliveries on that. You know, I'd be amazed if Level isn't using the 321. We see the 321 being an aircraft that could be used in British Airways and in Iberia. So it's a it's an aircraft that opens up new opportunities in what traditionally has been a, if you like, a low demand long haul segment that you can't really serve efficiently with the existing wide body aircraft.
And at the other end of the spectrum, is there any role that could provide some kind of salvation for Airbus or the 380 as a high density? And we've heard about a very specific role at Hajj flights with Malaysia.
No, it's too expensive.
Can you be a bit more clear about that,
Willie? It's a great aircraft for us. You know, we've got 12 of them working in British Airways. We're very pleased with them. But no, I don't see
don't
it.
See
working.
It. No. Okay. A few questions come in for you on the iPad, Willie. Your counterparts, this is completely off the subject specifically, your counterparts at Air France, Lufthansa, American, Delta and United have joined forces to oppose the Gulf carriers. Why haven't you?
Well, because you know, I don't believe the argument. You know, this argument that the Gulf carriers are bad is just a nonsense. So you know, we've taken a very simple view. We will beat the competition by competing against them. We're not going to try and beat the competition by forcing regulators to stop them competing with us. Very same with Norwegian. You know, we supported Norwegian's application for their license to operate Norwegian Ireland. You know, I've been very clear and very open. We'll compete with them, but we'll beat them through fair competition. And you know, we compete more than anybody with the Gulf carriers. You know, Emirates' first long-haul destination they served was London.
Mm-hmm. They so six had, a day on Heathrow, I think.
Yeah, but you know, we make money flying between Heathrow and Dubai. We make money going head-to-head with Emirates. I've always seen them as very rational in terms of their pricing and their network. They're doing what you know we did for years: six freedom traffic, building up a hub. So they're not doing anything that we haven't done, and for that reason, you know, I think it's wrong. And particularly, you know, it's a bit hypocritical for airlines in Europe to talk about state aid when you know we continue to see airlines all around Europe availing of state aid, even when they shouldn't, and when they've availed of it before. So you know, our view is we'll compete, and I'm not going to waste any time trying to argue with regulators, and clearly the regulators haven't bought into it. So you know, we have good competition against Emirates in particular, and with Etihad, and we competed against Qatar for many years. We're now in a joint venture with them, but you know, we're going to compete against these airlines and beat them through competition rather than try and get some, you know, some quirk of regulatory, you know, historical crap. You know, who wants to go back to the days when this was an industry that was, you know, over-regulated, where, you know, somebody in an office that didn't understand the industry told you where you could fly, how often you could fly, and how much you could charge. I don't want to be part of an industry like that.
What about, in that context, Brexit? I mean, again, Michael O'Leary has been saying very vocally, you know, it's, you know, the end, you know, we're going to have no flights for the day that Brexit comes into force. Other players in the industry are more mild in what they've said. Are we going to get the politicians to move quickly enough to keep what we've got and not have that slip back that you described?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think this, I think Michael actually helps to focus the argument at times. You know, I think his extreme views are often interesting because although probably nobody believes them, you know, people will sort of stop and ask the question, is he right? So, you know, he's been clear that for airlines to have certainty around their ability to sell, we need to know what the environment will be by, he originally said by March of next year, and then he, you know, he drifted out to September of next year, because I think it's clear we're not going to know by March of next year. But I'm convinced that this, you know, there are issues that need to be addressed, but I don't share his extreme view of the world that, you know, flights will stop at the end of March of 2019. Aviation has been the key success of the EU. You know, when you look at what the liberalised environment in Europe has meant for consumers, nobody well, with the exception of some airlines who would love to be regulated again so they don't have to worry about competition. But nobody wants to see the clock turn back where flying becomes the preserve of extremely wealthy people.
And in terms of, you mentioned earlier about getting volunteer pilots and crew, cabin crew to work on level. There's a question here saying, how do you deal with old-style labour regulations and unions when it comes to long-haul low-cost?
Well, you deal with the people involved. But we will create level as a standalone company. It will have its own AOC. But what we're saying very clearly is we have no objection. We don't mind who flies the aircraft, and we've got people within the group who would love to fly it. For a lot of pilots, as you know, the opportunity to fly a wide-body aircraft on a long-haul network is very attractive compared to flying narrow-body on a short-haul network. So with the right conditions, we believe we can have people from other parts of the group operating on that. But I think it's a great reflection on the maturity and the understanding that the Iberia unions have had, that they wanted to be involved in this. They saw this as an opportunity to create more jobs and to expand. And they recognised that it was something that wasn't going to happen unless, the terms and conditions were appropriate. And we're not talking about pay. The pay is good and the pay is competitive. It's the productivity
of the staff.
And as you know, in many cases, working agreements are legacy working agreements that may have been relevant when they were first drawn up. We need working agreements that reflect this new environment and new competitive position. And people get it. So I'm not going to say it's easy, it's not, but I think it's a great tribute to Luis Gallego and the team at Iberia and the trade unions that they've been able to get to this position. So you can do it in dialogue, so long as people understand what the objective is and understand what the opportunity and the rewards will be. And we've done that.
Well, just thinking about that, the way you described that, the hard work between management and unions. If we look at Ryanair's predicament of the last week, this seeming shock, a small percentage of flights cancelled, but a lot because of their scale. Any observations you can share on what happened there? I mean, they've said, well, we screwed up, but Ryanair isn't usually a company that screws up in such a public way.
No, it's not, and in fact, I think it's come as a great surprise to everybody that it has happened. But I think the one thing we can say for sure is they will fix it. Whatever about screwing up, their ability to fix things and their ability to move forward is, it's unparalleled, to be honest with you. Now, at one level, I would have loved to have been, sitting there watching what was going on. But I'm sure the blood on the wall has probably been washed off now. But it is unusual, and I don't take any real pleasure out of it because these problems, we've had our fair share of problems, and I don't get any pleasure at people laughing at me when I have a problem. So I'm not going to laugh at them. We'll wait and see if there's any opportunities out of this.
Well, this question about getting through problems. I mean, your big tough experience, quite fresh to BA, was Terminal 5, melting down on day one and having to resolve that, but it came back ultra strong and functional. Alex Cruz, taking over in BA, had the IT, it's not an IT failure, but the IT wasn't working because somebody seemingly switched something off.
It wasn't seemingly, they
did.
Switched it off,
Do you have clarity about that, happened? Will any more be said publicly? I know you're going to get a report done, an audit.
There's absolute clarity around what happened. We know exactly what happened and we know why it happened. It's one of those things that should never have happened, but it did. Other airlines and other companies should learn from, our, I wouldn't say it was our failure, but we'll learn from, the problem that we faced. And I've always been very clear about that. Learning from things that go wrong is incredibly
powerful. It's a positive.
As long as you don't keep repeating them,
it can
be a very healthy thing to do. And the one thing I think you can be sure, Ryanair are not going to face the same problem that they faced. They will fix it. And they've got it well within their own ability in the near term to fix that with the winter schedule coming along at the end of October. So, I think it's got to be an interesting case study for people to learn from, and we should all learn from it because other airlines have got their crew arrangements long as
well. Oh, crew shortages happen all the time.
Yeah, it's not that long ago before another big low-cost airline had a very similar problem and went through that. So this is an industry that learns from experience, and hopefully everybody will learn from what.
Do you think in a strange way, I mean, as a seasoned CEO, almost you need to have that at least once. I mean, Alex has had it now, you've had it, Muniz has had it in United, now Michael's had it. Is it something that actually builds you? What doesn't kill you strengthens you?
Yeah, but what's better is if somebody else keeps having it. And,
not you.
It's much easier that way.
Other things going on in the market right now. We've got the Alitalia situation playing out. I think IAG hasn't put a bid in for any part of that.
No. Okay. And to be honest, I'm unclear as to what's happening with Alitalia. We did participate in the process at the beginning, but we quickly withdrew. We've no interest. What we're doing in Italy is growing organically there. Vueling has put more capacity into Italy, been a good market for them. They've got a very strong presence there, and they will continue to build up there. So the commercial team in Vueling have been looking at opportunity to expand in Italy, serving the market to and from Italy, not so much the Italian domestic market. And we'll continue to, and there's good opportunity, because the longer this uncertainty about Alitalia continues, the more opportunity there is for airlines who are in that. So that's been very good for us. We did put in a binding bid for part of the Air Berlin.
I was going to ask you that.
So. Yeah, so we have done that, and there's been some media speculation in relation to that. I think it comes as no surprise to everybody that it appears Lufthansa is going to get it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. I don't think it matters what price they were going to pay.
They'd get it anyway.
It was going to be dressed up in a way that would make it look attractive to Lufthansa. So, we talked about, in Italy you had an Italian solution to an Italian problem with Alitalia. I think you've got a German solution to a German problem in Germany. And it's disappointing that, we get political interference in what should be a... commercial market, but this one, I think from every angle, it looks like it was designed to facilitate Lufthansa. But we'll wait and see. We haven't heard anything officially yet.
You've talked a lot, of course, about cost. And just one simple question, I think, that really sums it up. What is the single most key differentiator of cost excellence in IAG compared to other carriers? Maybe that's one of your teams is put that there as a little plan for you.
Yeah, I'll get that. It's not one thing, it's everything.
Yes.
So clearly we're at routes, and I've heard airports in the past talk about airport charges are not a significant part of the cost base. I can remember being at a presentation at Dublin Airport back in 2001, where they were saying airport charges are insignificant for an airline. And until I pointed out to them that at that time, our airport charges as a percentage of our cost base was exactly the same as our fuel costs, exactly the same. And I said, I've never heard anybody say fuel costs are insignificant for an airline. Every aspect of the cost base is important. And clearly airport charges are a critical issue for us. And more so, we need to be much more focused on every aspect of the cost base. And we have to, because we've got competitors out there who have been more focused than us in the past, and we're still trying to catch up.
I mean, we're here. This is an audience, and this is the event for airports and airlines doing the horse trading across the table about routes and costs. Are we in a new era where airlines have woken up, toughened up about costs beyond the low cost? Have airports changed too?
Well, I think airlines have definitely changed. We've changed.
Yeah.
We're looking at all of our costs, and we're looking at the way we operate at airports. It's fair to say that, maybe as airlines we haven't been as efficient as we should. And I think it's a great thing again when we look at IAG that we can benchmark our costs for Vueling, Aer Lingus, British Airways, Iberia, and now LEVA. And we have different costs at the same airports in some cases. I'll leave LEVA out of it for the moment. But when we looked at some of the airports that we were operating to, we had completely different cost charging structures. But in some cases, we had different demands on the airport. So the challenge for us, again, going back to serving customers, is are these demands that benefit us as airlines, or were they designed to benefit our customers? And in many cases, it wasn't that relevant to the customer. So we've got to look at what does the customer really need, and how can we serve those needs in the most efficient way possible. And in some cases, we've worked extremely well with some airports, and there are other airports that just don't get it. They just don't get it. They have no idea what cost means, because they've never had to. And I'll call Heathrow out on this one. They have never understood the need to be cost competitive. because in their view, people will just queue up to replace anybody that leaves. And you know, they have seen some competition introduced through the breakup of BAA, but not enough. And this is the first time, now that they're faced with trying to justify the cost of expansion, that they've had to try and understand what cost means. And you know, with the challenge that we've put and that the British government and the CAA has put to Heathrow, you know, we support expansion at Heathrow, but only if you keep passenger costs flat. Now, in my view, it should be passenger costs reducing. But in the past, this would have been, you know, let's spend as much money as we want, and the more the merrier, and let's put prices up because we just transfer all of this cost to the airline, and those dumb fuckers will just keep paying. You know, so those days are over. Those days are over. We're not going to do that anymore.
Well, yeah, we're officially out of time. I just want to squeeze a quick one. So somebody's asked, will you always fly to Sydney? And if you did, would you go via Singapore, or would you look at going via Doha?
No, I believe we will fly to Sydney. We did.
You were kind of quite happy it went at one point, weren't you, before switching to a 777?
Well, I didn't believe it would be financially successful for us based on the historical route performance. But when we changed it to a 777-300ER and... you know, the end of the joint business we had with Qantas, it's been a very successful route for us. And serving it over Singapore definitely works for us. So, you know, we're very happy with the way it's operating. So, in my opinion, yes, we'll continue to serve Sydney and we'll continue to serve it over Singapore.
Willie, I think we have got to wrap up, unfortunately, now. And you probably get off to some of the important business. So, Willie Walsh, thanks very much. CEO of IAG.